Okay, good evening, everybody, and people on Zoom, good evening. Just move this a little bit closer so I can see you. That's better. Well, I think as everyone, or almost everyone here knows, we're in the middle of our practice period, and we're focusing during this practice period on what we call right relationship. And I was thinking, you know, maybe another word may be wise, a wise relationship to the various things that we've talked about. When Kate and I first talked about what I'm going to talk about tonight, right relationship to food, or maybe wise relationship to food is one of the topics, I noticed in myself a kind of hesitancy. After all, we've been considering relationship to our body, to personal injury or sickness or imperfection, relationship to isolation or loneliness, family relationships, community relationships, intimate relationships, relationship to identity, all very kind of serious and important. And somehow comparing these relationships, compared to these relationships, relationship to food seemed kind of trivial at first, or at least of less importance. But upon reflection, I realized this is not true. But perhaps the endless discussion about diets and nutrition over the many years has desensitized many of us from seriously considering what is our relationship to food. Not in terms of diet or nutrition, but from the point of view of our values and our aspiration regarding food. So I'd like to talk about that tonight. And let's begin by considering some of the early writings about food in the Buddhist tradition. The Buddha taught that a gift of food is fivefold. In the Bhojana Sutta, one of the early texts, we read this. In giving a meal, the donor gives five things to the recipient. Which five? She gives life, beauty, happiness, strength, and quick-wittedness or discernment, depending on the translation. That's what you give. And I thought, how beautiful. What a beautiful thought that in preparing a meal for someone, it includes these gifts as well. In the story of the Buddha's life, we learn that it was only after he gave up fasting and other austerities and accepted a meal that his mind cleared and he entered into a meditation that led to his awakening. And the meal offered to him was by Sujata, the daughter of the local village headman. And she made Siddhartha an offering of a bowl of sweet rice cooked in condensed milk. And it was this meal that gave Siddhartha the strength to sit under the tree, awaken, and get the title of the Buddha, the awakened one. So in a way, it was Sujata's offering of this simple, nourishing meal that made possible the Buddhist tradition that supports us today. So from the very beginning, food has been acknowledged as part of a spiritual life in the Buddhist tradition. During the life of the Buddha, the monks and nuns would each morning walk through the villages and towns that were nearby to receive alms of food. In exchange, they would offer Buddhist teachings. Lay people would place a small package or a small amount of cooked food like rice or different curries that they had prepared for their own meals into the large bowls that each of the monastics carried. And this practice is still done today in places like Thailand, Cambodia, Sri Lanka. The monastic is instructed not to prefer a rich person's home or a home where high quality food is known to be prepared, but to simply silently receive whatever is offered. And in this way, the monastic meets the lay community every day and eats the food that the lay community shares with him or her. So this the kind of daily dependence on alms food reminds both the monastics and the lay people of their kind of interdependence and prevents the monk or nun from becoming too isolated, I think, from the community at large. Now, there are some do's and don'ts with this practice. So here's a couple that I found interesting. First of all, no special requests for certain food can be made, right? Unless you're ill, unless you're sick. In the monastic code, this is written, there are sumptuous foods, namely foods mixed with ghee, butter, oil, honey, molasses, fish, meat, milk, and curd. And a monk or nun who, though not sick, asks for such sumptuous foods and eats them, commits an offense. So you'd have to, there'd be some kind of penalty for doing that. The second thing is this. If meat or fish is placed in the alms bowl on a daily round, it should be eaten with the rest of the food. However, no meat or fish may be eaten if the animal or fish has been killed specifically for the monastics. For example, if a group of monks or nuns is invited to a feast, you can't eat any meat that would be served there. And this reminded me of a modern version of this, which Robert Eiken Roshi, one of the venerable elders of Zen in the West, I think he died in 2010. But this is what he said. He said that if he goes to a dinner party and is served meat, he will eat it. Because, quote, the cow is dead and the hostess is not. So that was his take on the monastic code around eating meat. But unlike the monastics who practice this kind of alms receiving every morning, many of us living in prosperous times and societies like here take food for granted and are largely unaware of how it's produced and comes into the supermarkets. Even the very definition of food has changed from what, for example, our great-grandparents would recognize. This is an age of highly refined food processing and packaging. Right? What would your great-grandparents make of Captain Crunch cereal? Or the fact that high-fructose corn syrup is found in just about everything? Our great-grandparents may not understand the anxiety that arises as we each are confronted with the incredibly complicated and confusing question of what we should eat to be maximally healthy. At times, I think that after all these decades of research on nutrition, we would finally know what to eat to maintain our health. But the advice given to us just keeps shifting, kind of like shifting sands, right? I remember, this may be letting you know how old I am, but butter was bad. Don't eat butter. Now butter is not so bad. Eat butter. Don't eat margarine. I remember, and you probably remember this too, oat bran was the superfood. Now it's no longer a superfood. Avocados are superfood, right? Or blueberries are superfood. Fat was bad for the heart. And now we learn there actually is no link between a low-fat diet and the rates of coronary disease. Michael Pollan, who I'm probably a name most of you know, who writes, he's written extensively about food, the food industry, has written in several essays and in his book, Defense of Food, that nutritional science and food industry marketing has created our present state of dietary confusion and anxiety. He writes in one essay, "The nutritional imperatives of the food industry, nutritional science, and journalism, three parties that stand to gain much from widespread confusion surrounding what is, after all, the most elemental question of the most elemental question an omnivore confronts, what to eat." In reading some articles as I was preparing this talk, I came across a really unusual word, nutritionalism. You ever heard of that, nutritionalism? Nutritionalism is an ideology based on the widely shared but unproven or unexamined assumption that nutrition, the things in the food, is what is the key to understanding the values that food contains. The nutriments are key. That's the assumption. So, what happens? This gave rise to the supplements industry, for example. The antioxidants, right? In fresh produce, the compounds like beta-carotene, vitamin E, these subdue the free radicals in our body, which can damage our DNA and cause cancers. So then making supplements of these antioxidants would make sense, right? But as Michael Pollan points out, extensive research now shows that the antioxidant supplements don't work. They don't give the same benefits as eating our fruits and vegetables. We need to eat the whole food to get the benefit. It's not just a nutriment inside the food. So another part, I think, of our collective confusion around food is our struggle with body image and what to eat. Many of us search for a diet that will finally free us from suffering with a poor body image, a kind of magical group of foods or way of eating that will fix us and liberate us to enjoy the fullness of life. And the internet provides a vast list of diets and different food recommendations put together both by experts and non-experts. And that list, of course, continues to grow week by week, practically. As I was looking at some of these lists, just briefly, I kind of thought there are two main categories here. One is on maximizing one's health, and the other is on eating righteously. So at times these two streams overlap, of course. Now, I don't want to give the impression that following a diet or taking supplements are inherently wrong-headed. I think both can be an appropriate measure depending on the individual. In the past decades, though, we have collectively lost a compassionate and true view of our bodies. We have lost trust in the innate wisdom and basic goodness of our bodies, largely because of the food industry. We have largely forgotten how to listen to the messages that our body gives us. caught in the struggle to follow the ever-changing messages about diet, supplements, health food trends, I think we experience another kind of malnutrition because we don't listen to what our bodies are telling us. Just as we need to restore wise relationship or right relationship with our own body, we need to restore wise relationship, right relationship to our food. So, what does the Buddhist tradition say about right relationship to food? Well, we have some clues from the early Buddhist tradition that I spoke of at the beginning of the talk. So now let's consider this tradition, the Zen tradition itself. When I was thinking about this, of course, my mind immediately leapt to the practice of oryoki, the formal way we eat meals in retreat. Oryoki, Japanese word, the O means in proportion to. Ryo means the amount or quantity. And ki means container, oryoki. So we may translate it as literally as container that holds just enough. For those of you who haven't yet experienced oryoki, an intricately knotted cloth package holds three nested bowls, black bowls usually, and chopsticks and a spoon and a small spatula, a napkin and a drying cloth. And these simple tools allow us to make each meal a kind of intricate and meticulous practice. Now, I'm not going to describe the choreography. It's much better if you can see it and perform it for yourself. But for those of you who are coming to Loon Lake, you'll soon experience that if you haven't experienced it already. But what I really want to talk about is the chants, the chanting that we do with oryoki. And I'm just going to pick out some of the lines to talk about. So here are some. We reflect on the effort that brought us this food and consider how it comes to us. We reflect on our virtue and practice and whether we are worthy of this offering. We regard it as essential to keep the mind free from excesses such as greed. We regard this food as good medicine to sustain our life. For the sake of enlightenment, we now receive this food. These beautiful lines evoke a state of gratitude and awareness for the effort and boundless interconnections that allowed the food, that allowed for the food in each of these bowls, these three bowls that are now out in front of us. The sun, the soil, seeds, the gardeners, farmers, the packers, the truck drivers, the food choppers, the cooks, and all that supported those who created the meal. We acknowledge it. We acknowledge it as a vast web of interconnection. We reflect on the effort that brought us this food and consider how it comes to us. The next line brings us into the present moment, reminding us of our vows and the effort to follow the Buddhist path. We are reminded why we eat, to nurture our body and awaken our compassion and wisdom. Right? We reflect on our virtue and practice and whether we are worthy of this offering. We regard it as essential to keep the mind free from excesses such as greed. For the sake of enlightenment, for the sake of awakening compassion and wisdom, we now receive this food. And then the next lines in the chant kind of go like this. First is for the three treasures, next for the four benefactors, finally for the beings in the six realms. May all be equally nourished. The first bite is to end all harm, the second to cultivate all good, the third to free all beings. May we all realize the Buddha way. Now this passage begins by offering the food to others. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the four benefactors, which traditionally are one's mother and father, teacher, and the ruler who maintains the peace. Those are the traditional four benefactors. And finally, for everybody, for all the beings transmigrating the great realms of samsara, right, that we've talked about before. The hell realm, the hungry ghost realm, the animal realm, the human realm, the realm of the fighting spirits, the heavenly realm, everybody. We offer this food to them too. For me, this part of the chant acknowledges that this food, this eating of the food, is not just for me, but something I do with and for all beings. Because we are supported by all beings, and so in turn, we should nurture all beings. In the very last line, the last part of the chant, we affirm our intention to act in a wholesome way, to live together with all beings and not cause harm. And I think throughout all of the chant, we see the focus on thankfulness for the food that we receive, a kind of gratitude. Daidalori Roshi, the now deceased abbot of the Zen Mountain Monastery in New York, writes this in his book, Celebrating Everyday Life. But odyoki is not just a prescribed form of ritual. It is a state of mind. It's not about chanting and bowing and bells. It is a state of consciousness. Because food is life, it is of utmost importance that we receive it with the deepest gratitude. When we eat, we consume life, whether it's cabbage or cows, it's life. Now, when Daidalori Roshi uses the phrase state of mind, he's talking about mindfulness. And mindfulness is deliberately paying attention to what you're doing, but without judgment or criticism. Being fully aware when eating of what is happening both inside yourself, in your body, heart and mind, but also outside yourself, your environment. That is the practice of mindful eating. When we eat without mindfulness, our relationship to food is really fuzzy or vague. We've all experienced, you know, eating something like popcorn, chips, or some kind of other snack food while watching TV or a movie, right? The hand and mouth move almost automatically, and the food kind of goes down. We hardly taste it. And the stomach may feel extended, but we remain somehow unsatisfied. Remember I said a kind of malnourishment is there. Something is not fed, even though the stomach is full. Mindful eating is, mindful eating is mindful. Mindful of the colors, the textures, the smells, the tastes, the sounds of eating. It allows us to be curious as we investigate our responses to food and our inner cues to hunger and satisfaction. Jan Chosen Bays, a doctor and co-abbot of the Great Vow Monastery in Oregon, wrote a book called Mindful Eating, A Guide to Rediscovering a Healthy and Joyful Relationship to Food. Kate has conducted a workshop on mindful eating here at Mountain Rain based on Chosen's teachings. I think a few years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It's been a while. Okay, it's time to do it again, Kate. So in this book that Chosen wrote, is this. She writes, "In the Zen tradition, we practice bringing skillful attention, curiosity, inquiry to all our activities, including the activities of tasting and eating. The Zen teachings encourage us to explore the present moment fully, asking ourselves questions like, am I hungry? Where do I feel hunger? What part of me is hungry? What do I crave? What am I tasting right now?" Chosen goes on in this book to describe what she calls the 7 kinds of hunger. Quite interesting. These 7 kinds are eye hunger, nose hunger, mouth hunger, stomach hunger, cellular hunger, mind hunger, and heart hunger. And then she offers an example of each with some exercises to become aware of what kind of hunger you may be experiencing and then ways to satisfy it. Now, we can't examine all those kinds of hunger here, but I'd like us to consider for a moment what she calls mind hunger, which at first glance does not seem like hunger at all. Mind hunger is based on the ideas of good food, bad food. Good food, bad food, right? Which can become absolutes for us. It's the thoughts we have around what we should eat and should not eat, based mostly on the advice of experts. Maybe that expert should be quote unquote. Here's a quote again from Michael Pollan that I think addresses this quite well. He says, he writes this about the American food industry. "By marketing directly to every demographic, children included, the food industry has made us a nation where each of us is trying to work out our dietary salvation on our own. We've learned to choose foods by the numbers. Calories, carbs, fats, RDAs, relying more heavily on our reading skills than upon our senses. Indeed, we have lost confidence in our senses, our senses of taste and smell, which cannot take the invisible macro and micronutrients science has taught us to worry about. And the food processors have become adept at deceiving us anyway." He writes, "Processed foods are marketed less on the basis of taste than on convenience, image, predictability, and health claims, all of which are easier to get right in a processed food product than flavor." He says, "It is no wonder we have become, in the midst of our astounding abundance, the world's most anxious eaters." So that's kind of what he's talking about, mind hunger, right? So how does one satisfy mind hunger? That kind of worry, anxiety about what to eat, what not to eat. Chosen offers that maybe we can't. But she says we can cultivate awareness. And she writes, "When we're filled with awareness, that there comes a satisfaction with that." So what is right relationship to food? Well, like other relationships that we've looked at over the past weeks, I think we have to each investigate for ourselves. Each of us has our own body, with its own unique qualities. And the Zen teaching encourages us to listen carefully to what our bodies are telling us, and to be aware of the interbeing of all things. Eating popcorn while watching a movie is not inherently bad. Following a diet is not inherently bad. But the Zen tradition tells us, examine what you're doing. Are you doing it out of habit and conditioning? What are you doing out of choice? The early Buddhist tradition encourages us to accept the food that comes, to eat with gratitude, to be conscious of the great web of life and our place in it. And the Zen tradition also inspires us to express gratitude, to bring awareness to our eating and sources of food. And the teaching that eating food, like Zazen, is a profound practice. Dogen Zenji writes, Dogen, the Japanese monk who brought this practice from China to Japan in the 1200s, he writes, at the very moment when we eat, we are possessed of ultimate reality, essence, substance, energy, activity, causation. So Dharma is eating, and eating is Dharma. I'm sure you've all heard the expression, a guilty pleasure. It's one my mother used a lot when she ate things that she felt she shouldn't eat. You know, like the cheesecake, the cinnamon roll, the, what else would she eat that she, it was mostly cheesecake and cinnamon rolls. She was a pretty big cinnamon roll person. And I notice in myself at times there's a kind of guilty pleasure. So I really like this last line. Dharma is eating, and eating is Dharma. Why not just completely enjoy the cinnamon roll and leave the guilt? Anyway, maybe that can be our practice this week. Eat something free of any kind of, any taint of guilt. Dharma. This is Dharma. Okay, I'll stop here. Thank you for listening. And is that going to tell me the time? I can't quite see it on here. Oh, Aetherbite, good, we have time. So we have time to get into groups, which we've been doing regularly. And let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We'll get into two groups here. And once people have left who need to leave, I'll put you into groups. And I'd like you to do two things, or maybe one, depending on time. Each person will get roughly 3 minutes to talk. I'd like you to, what is your relationship to food or to eating, depending on how you want to frame it? And then how would you like to change it, if at all? What is your relationship to food? And how would you like to change it? And maybe you don't want to change it. And that's fine too. You have a very wise relationship with food. Okay. So I'll put the people on Zoom here into groups. And then I'll call you back. Each person will get about 3 minutes. Please self-time people here on the Zoom. And the people here, if someone can give me the bell, I'll I'll time you there. Okay, any questions? Okay, good. Thank you. Yeah, I think that will do it. Oops. No, I didn't do it. Okay, hang on. I've got to redo this. Okay, group of three, and then Will, do you want to come over here? So I have to wait till it closes, right? Okay, there we go. Okay. So recreate.
I think we do, yeah.